This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, peel language a grape. Coming up in today's show are some of the ways mistakes have crept into the English language and stayed there, like linguistic penicillin mould or post-it note glue. Content note, there's a bit of swearing in this episode, very educational swearing. If you're doing Dry January but for swearing, then it's okay to continue playing this. The bit with the swears will be after the main part of the episode, like a little bonus featurette. So, swear enthusiasts should listen right to the end. Remember, an Allusionist episode is not over till you hear the dictionary slam shut. Plus about 20 more seconds after that. On with the show.
There never has been a golden age when everything was as it should be, ever. You know, we tend to think that English is now at its most dumbed down, always. I think every generation has thought that.
This is Susie Dent. She's a lexicographer and writer, and if you've ever watched television in Britain in the daytime, you may well have seen her on the game show Countdown, sitting in Dictionary Corner, figuring out anagrams at lightning speed and knowing language inside out. And within the English language, there are a lot of words that came about by mistake. Take the word dawd, which was accidentally printed in the 1934 edition of the New International Dictionary.
Capital D or lowercase d was just given as an abbreviation for density, used by physicists and chemists, and then some typesetter thought it was D-O-R-D rather than D or D, and it became dawd. And so dawd is now pretty much a kind of byword for any mistake in a dictionary.
As well as whole words that were errors, there are letters within words, phantom letters, that have no basis in etymology, such as the B in doubt.
That was put there possibly by one single hand, one scribe who wanted centuries ago to kind of return English to its kind of classical heritage. And there was a lot of this going on where I thought, we've got to look to the Latin, you know, that's the kind of perfect, pristine, pure language that we want to return to. So it was D-O-W-T, doubt, before in Old English. And they just thought, no, but the Latin is dubitum. So let's just stick a B in there. But of course, the pronunciation didn't change. And that's the story behind so many different silent letters in English, of which there are vast quantities.
Like the B in plumber. Why is plumber pronounced plumber and not plumber, like lumber?
Again, it was a vigorous nod to the Latin plumbum, which meant a lead pipe. So we stuck a B in, but we didn't change the pronunciation. But as for mistakes, those same scribes during the Renaissance didn't always get it right. So to this day, we have the S in island, the silent S in island, because they thought it came from the Latin insula. So they put one in, where in fact Eagland, which is I-E-G-L-A-N-D with no S, was there in Old English all along and probably came from the Vikings. So they didn't always get it right when they thought, let's have a look at the Latin or the Greek indeed as well. And one of my favourite historical hiccups goes back five centuries or more, and that is the H in ghost. And that goes back to William Caxton's team of Flemish typesetters, because he learnt his trade in Flanders.
William Caxton was an English merchant and diplomat. While working in Northern Europe in the mid-15th century, he spotted the new printing presses being used in Germany and set up his own in Flanders, then returned to England to introduce the printing press there too, bringing his team of Flemish typesetters with him.
And their native Flemish at the time for ghost was geest with an H, that was G-H-E-E-S-T. And so they thought, well, let's lob an H into the Old English ghost, spelt without an H, because it looked wrong to them. Not only do we now have the silent H in ghost, but we also had the ricochet effect, which meant that aghast and ghastly, each of which were perfectly happy without the H before they came along, they put an H in there as well. So they inherited an extra letter. So, you know, that was just so arbitrary, really, and so down to kind of personal taste.
Sometimes a letter gets detached from one word and attaches to the adjacent word. For example, an apron used to be a napron.
Originally, an apron was a napron. It goes back to the French nap. That's sort of like a tablecloth, for example. And what happened was people in spoken language, obviously, we're saying an apron, a napron, and the N somehow got attached to the A rather than the napron. And so it changed. People assumed that it was an apron rather than a napron, napron.
This process has a few different names: misdivision, meta-analysis, re-bracketing.
The same thing happened in lots and lots of different words. So an umpire used to be a non-peer or an umpire, which meant a non-peer. In other words, it was somebody whose status was different to the players on the pitch. An adder was a nadder originally, and then the A again sort of floated away. We've actually been doing this so often.
We really have. A newt used to be an ute. And here's another good one. Nickname, which was misdivided 500 or so years ago. Before that, the word was eek name. Eek meant also or additional. Your eek name was your additional name. An eek name became a neek name. And at some point, the vowel shortened, giving us nickname. Here's another term for your big book of big words: metathesis, when letters get swapped around, as the letter R did in nostril, which used to be nose thurl. Thurl in Old English meant a hole, but the letters got muddled around to thrill, nose thrill.
And the nose thrill, the thrill there meant to pierce, and is related to, you know, when we talk about a thrilling experience, because a thrilling experience pierces us. It pierces our emotions. But to thrill originally meant to kind of stab somebody with a knife.
No.
And create a hole. And a nose thrill was a hole in your nose. So it was a nose thrill originally. So it's a very roundabout story, but that was another one that, underwent metathesis.
Sometimes when we mess with a word, it's because we've been overthinking it.
For example, cherry. A cherry comes from the French cerise, which still means cherry in French. And because cerise sounded plural, we thought, oh, well, cerise or cherries must be plural. So we'll work back a little bit and have cherry for the singular, when in fact cerise is singular in the first place. So these kind of weird workings out that we've been doing, I say weird, they're actually fairly logical. We've just been trying to make things sit more comfortably on our tongue. So nowadays, like my mum, who was trying very hard, I guess, to be posh when I was growing up, had a chaise lounge in her bedroom, which was not the chaise longue, which you will find in French, but chaise lounge sounded completely logical.
And some of the tweaked versions of words do make sense. Shamefaced was originally shamefast, held fast by shame. But having a face full of shame is also an illusion that works.
Buttonholing somebody these days, which makes perfect sense, as if you're putting your finger through a buttonhole on their jacket and pulling them towards you. But actually, it used to be buttonholed. Holding someone by the button. Hangnail is another one that seems, you know, to make sense. It's that painful little bit of skin that seems to hang from the fingernail. But actually, it goes back to agnail in Middle English. The ag there meant painful. It's related to anger. One of my favourite stories is the Jerusalem artichoke. You know, what's that got to do with Jerusalem? Absolutely nothing, as it turns out. It goes back to the French and ultimately the Italian girasol, meaning a sunflower, because the artichoke is a heliotrope. It turns towards the sun. But because we couldn't say girasol or girasola, we changed it to Jerusalem, which was the closest sounding thing we could find.
That familiar linguistic process, making something more like a thing it sounds a bit like.
When we curry favour today, we've completely lost sight of a wonderful story involving a horse called Favel, who once belonged to a king and was brushed down by fawning courtiers to sort of get into the king's good books. And so when we curried Favel, we were originally taking a curry comb and brushing the horse down. And Favel, of course, was completely lost from view. So we decided that favour made perfect sense, as it does. So we curry favour these days and have totally lost the original story.
That story sounds too good to be true.
I know. But yeah, carrying Favel, who knew? But yes, I mean, I think thanks to social media, we will probably be trending towards things rather than tending towards them in the future. To all intensive purposes is making inroads now as well. I mean, there are ludicrous examples as well, but who knows whether they'll stick around. So a jaw-dropping experience, like a bowl in a china shop. Being lactose intolerant, which makes perfect sense to me in the morning. right from the gecko, you know, all of these. And we have to mention malaphors as well. They're mixtures of metaphors and malapropisms. And they're the really plausible utterances that we kind of inadvertently offer up. And we've all got some. Famous one is something isn't rocket surgery, which makes sense. I'll burn that bridge when I come to it. Like lemmings to the slaughter. And the thing is, once you tune in, you can't stop hearing them. So when I was in the loo once, there were two women chatting over the cubicles, and one of them said, "You wash my back, sweetheart, and I'll wash yours," which I thought was wonderful.
That's a good deal as well.
It's a very good deal. So yes, lots and lots of malaphors around, lots of the famous egg corns being a term for the rewriting of our expressions. And that was because of an overheard mangling of the word acorn. And there was a brilliant, brilliant error in a newspaper column, I don't know, a few months ago now. It was in a jazz column of a newspaper where the correction notice said, in yesterday's paper, in Chris, I'm reading this out now, Chris's jazz albums column, we incorrectly referred to Don Rendell as a terrorist when it clearly should have been tenorist. We apologise for any offence.
So in that respect, correctness is important.
Very much so.
I asked Susie about her favourite etymologies.
I love the ones which you would never guess had a really, really literal story behind them. But they do. So stealing someone's thunder is one of my favourites, because linguists and lexicographers really rarely discover the exact moment when an expression was born. But we do think we know where stealing thunder comes from. And that involves a playwright manager from the 18th century called John Dennis. And he invented a machine that could reproduce the sound of thunder for his own play that he put on in London's Drury Lane Theatre. This is about 1709. Sadly, the thunder may have been good, but the play apparently wasn't, and it closed after a really short run, and it was replaced by a production of Macbeth. And he decided to show solidarity and to go along and support the company that succeeded him, and went along to the opening night, but was outraged by hearing the sound of thunder emanating from the stage and realised that they were using his own thunder machine. And records of the time tell how he stood up and shouted, "Damn them, they won't let my play run, but they steal my thunder." And we think it's his outburst that gave rise to our modern expression, which I love. And I also love the ones that kind of wear their hearts on their sleeves, but we just pass them by without thinking about them. So secretaries used to keep secrets. They were secretaries. Freelancers were knights that were free to use their lance for whomever paid them the most, rather than being attached to a single lord. Oh, and licking into shape. This possibly is my favourite of all time. This goes back to a belief that persisted into medieval times that bear cubs were born shapeless. So they were born as blobs, essentially, and then had to be licked into bear shape by their mothers.
I wonder why bears in particular.
I have no idea. I guess because people probably were never likely to be confronted with reality. So maybe they chose a story that was as kind of charming as it was, you know, unlikely ever to be disproved, at least for a while. Yeah, I just think it's a wonderful flight of imagination. It's just beautiful. And again, you know, we pass it by because it's just... seems to make sense, and you would never know that has this kind of glorious story hidden behind it.
Susie Dent is an author, lexicographer, and the stalwart of Countdown's Dictionary Corner. She is Susie_Dent on Twitter, and you'll love her account for the regular doses of etymology. And stick around now for an extra bit of etymology from Susie. Still with us? Good. Now here's the part of my conversation with Susie that turned to swearing.
Oh, my giddy aunt. I mean, who was the original giddy aunt and why was she so dizzy?
Is that a way of people not blaspheming by not saying, oh my God?
Yes. I mean, just obviously euphemisms. In the Middle Ages, it was less bodily functions and far more religious profanity that had to be avoided at all costs. So that's when a lot of our euphemisms emerged. So we had really, really quite convoluted ones as well. So one of the exclamations of the time was Gad's Budlikins. And Gad's Budlikins was a sort of corruption of God's body. And then you have gadzooks, which you will find in sort of 1920s, 1930s comics. Gadzooks, another exclamation, and that was a euphemism for God's hooks, i.e. the nails of the cross. So really quite sort of elaborate euphemisms came about then. And then there was gorblimey as well, which is kind of classic Cockney exclamation. That was God blind me. And then later on, Jiminy Cricket for Jesus Christ. You know, Jeepers Creepers, same thing, same initials.
Zoons as well, God's Wounds.
Zoons, God's Wounds, exactly.
Struth.
Struth, God's Truth. Yeah, all of that. Staying with swearing, bollocks is a sort of fairly standard Anglo-Saxon word, and it wasn't rude at all. It was just used fairly matter-of-factly for the testicles. But at the time as well, the sort of intestines were called, and this was a translation from the Bible, they were called arse ropes, which I absolutely love. And why don't we still call intestines arse ropes? I just think that just says it as it is, really. Acronyms are quite interesting as well, where we try to make sense of words by inventing acronyms for them. So shit, for example, famously people think is ship high in transit, something to do with combustible cow dung having to be stored high up on a boat for fear of explosion. And fuck, of course, and the backronym for that was fornication under consent of the king. There's no evidence for this whatsoever, but it said that in times of plague, when the population had been decimated, the monarch would decree that couples needed to get fornicating and producing. And so couples would hang F-U-C-K on their doors just to let the people know that they shouldn't be disturbed because they were fornicating under consent of the king. Again, absolute rubbish, but what a lovely story.
Zaltzman's first law of language is it's almost never an acronym.
Yes.
Especially if it's pre-20th century.
Yes.
Why do people always want it to be an acronym?
I don't know. I guess it's sort of easy, containable. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the sort of instinct is to, I guess it's just trying to make sense of things all the time, isn't it? And then we can compartmentalize them and sort of move on. Whereas in fact, I love the mysteries. I mean, there are so many frustrating entries in the OED where you think, God, there must be a good story behind that word. And then you'll find etymology unknown because the OED is famously cautious about etymology until it can actually nail something. So it tends not to give you all the theories surrounding it. Sometimes it will, but quite often it will just leave something as a mystery, which is frustrating, but also slightly exciting at the same time, because you know that people are still digging to find the true meaning and the true origin of something. So, you know, that work will never stop.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is liripipe, or liripoop. Noun, the long tail of a graduate's hood, a part or lesson committed to memory. A silly person. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with music by Martin Austwick of Song by Song Podcast. You can find Allusionist Show on Facebook and Twitter, and to find out about upcoming Allusionist-related events, to hear every episode or to read the transcripts, to obtain additional content about each episode topic, and to see the full dictionary entry of the randomly selected word, visit the show's forever home, theallusionist.org.